Brigadier Trevor, real tow.
Well, the Chinese managed to get into this gap and get behind the Royal Ulster Rifles, and the result is they were able to ambush part of the Royal Ulster Rifles in their withdrawal. And that battalion put up a magnificent battle, but had unfortunate, quite severe casualties. In that withdrawal, and in the Northumberland Fusiliers part, it was our point was rather interesting, which may amuse you, was that one of the officers who had taken out to the war in Korea had taken his suit of tails, and this was in a trunk in a trailer, and during the Chinese attack it had actually been overrun by the Chinese. I'm glad to say that he managed to get it back after the counterattack, but I can't imagine what the Chinese would have thought had they ever opened up the trunk and found a lovely tail evening coat inside the trunk.
So you took up new position south of Seoul then, did you?
After the withdrawal, we went south of Seoul and formed a line south of the River Imjin, which was a name which has become very famous later.
What were these positions like?
Well, it was a very wide frontage. I can't say how wide it must have been, about 8 miles wide, probably. And we had on the right flank the Northumberland Fusiliers, and just beyond them, by that time, the 1st Belgian Battalion had joined us. These were extremely nice, and nice, very nice people. I think they were all volunteers. In fact, one of the political leaders had volunteered to come out with them, and they came under our command and put up a very good show later. Then came the Northumberland Fusiliers, and then on the left flank, covering a crossing of the River Imjin, a small crossing, were the Gloucesters, who occupied several hills with a company on each, facing the River Imjin. And a crossing place, which was a ford of the River Imjin, which became known as Gloucester Crossing. This river was fairly fast flowing, and at times, after rainfall, could rise by 20 feet. So it could become a great barrier at certain times. By this time, we'd been through a very hard winter, where people had been found it terribly cold, something like 20 degrees below zero at times, and we fortunately did have this clothing, special trousers you put on top, which are windproof, and a jacket which is windproof, as well as our jerseys, and the long johns had last been used by people who'd laughed at them before, because no one knew that Korea was a cold place, or we'd forgotten, or something. We didn't seem to remember it was going to be a cold place. Of course, the Americans were dressed in parkas, big, thick, K-pot things. They had beautiful equipment, and we managed to get one or two of their stuff from them. The Chinese were dressed like a Michelin tire advertisement. They were covered in looked like a golf ball. They were surrounded by a kapok, which was thick, which they never got out of. They lived in it completely in these things. That's the North Koreans. Of course, the United States Air Force was doing a lot of bombing, and the type of bombing they did was to drop napalm, which is dropped on the Chinese positions, which of course it burst into flame, and of course it got onto their kapok suiting, and of course they had a terrible death.
What are your own personal opinions about the use of napalm?
Well, I think napalm is a wrong type of warfare to use that type of weapon. In the same way as flame throwing, anything like that, you might as well use chemicals because it's a horrible death and there's no defense against it.
But some people say that being hit by a bullet or high explosive is equally horrible.
Well, it's quite true. But bullet will kill you or wound you, some chance of recovery, but to be burnt alive is a horrible thing.
I think you were going to say some more about the use of air power.
Well, yes, of course it's all very one-sided, and the other thing is we were using it the first time with helicopters, and helicopters were great. We haven't seen much of them before in England, and here the Americans had these helicopters and could take messages and instructions and go and spot from helicopters for aircraft and use them very successfully. I remember one of the Americans coming to visit us with orders and jumped out of his helicopter and came to deliver a message. Unfortunately, something happened and the helicopter took off by itself and hovered at about 50 feet above us, and eventually it rushed off and rushed into the ground and smashed up. I don't know how he wrote that one off, but that's what happened to him.
Did helicopters seem to be notoriously unreliable?
No, I don't think they were. In fact, I don't remember any crashes at all. But of course, this one, of course, took off by itself.
Can we say something now about the military caliber of the Chinese enemy? Were they a formidable opponent?
Well, far as I know, and talking to people and reading about it afterwards, I mean, I was in headquarters. I'm not in the front line soldier or ever was attacked by a Chinese. But far as I know, they were given an order to go to attack a hill, something they could see. They had maps, naturally, and were given some target. And they attacked en masse. And they would go on until they hit the wire and then go on attacking. And I'm told, in some occasions, the ones at the rear of the columns were not armed at all and took the arms from their comrades who were casualties or killed. They didn't appear to have much artillery or weapons, but they didn't appear by day at all. In fact, you could fly over North Korea and you'd think there's no one there at all, because they were so cleverly camouflaged, deeply dug into hillsides, and at night the whole thing became alive, and things were moved, troops moved by night, and everything took place at night, resupply.
Did the British forces in Korea have respect or contempt for the Chinese?
I think we had quite good respect for them, because they were extremely brave. Because it's very brave to attack en masse, and against, when you've got, latterly we had wire, and they used to end up on the wire like flies against the window. And there were very heavy casualties at times.
Did you see Chinese captives, Chinese prisoners of war?
Yes. They seemed to be young, and I think the ones captured by the South Koreans were probably treated very cruelly. After all, they'd come down into their country and created thousands of casualties in South Korea, and when they were captured by the South Koreans, a lot of revenge took place. And I remember at our headquarters hearing that they were shooting the prisoners just a quarter mile down the road. And we thought this was disgraceful, because after all, we were on the same side, and it was done in the name of the United Nations that way we shoot prisoners. It struck us that we were partly responsible, and so we went down and arranged to stop it.
Did you personally go down?
No, I didn't personally do it, but we arranged to stop this thing going on. Not only that, you see, they were quite those people of their own side who had deserted and perhaps gone and joined up with some family of others, they were taken out and shot in front of open graves. In fact, a lot of atrocities were committed by the South Koreans.
But did you have any personal contact with such atrocities?
No, but the press, of course, were there and knew this was going on. In fact, the real reports on Korea have never been published, as far as I know, of what really the things they saw and knew about were going on. I knew one of the reporters who used to come to our headquarters pretty often, who was covering this aspect of the whole subject, but I don't think his story was ever written, because it was too difficult at that time to publish a thing of that type.
Who was this chap?
I don't know. I can't remember. One of the many reporters we had. We had a whole gang of reporters there. You see, this is the days before television, and the stories we got back to England was quite a lot of publicity we had, but not in the same way as the Falklands with the public, with the television and that sort of thing. And quite honestly, I don't think the British public were terribly interested in what was happening in Korea. And we were a sort of lost army out there fighting this war on behalf of the United Nations.
When the British people went down to the South Koreans to stop the shooting of prisoners, did the South Koreans comply with what the British said?
Oh, I think so. I think they said, well, they have a good reason to do it. In a very funny way, you see, you used to see these prisoners they'd got hold of, which had their hands behind their back, tied with cable wire, which was really bitten into the flesh, and was a funny way to take people around. You wonder what was going to happen to them, and I'm afraid a good many were just bumped off.
What was the demeanour of the prisoners? Did they seem terrified, or calm, or what?
No, the prisoners seemed typical Chinese. They're so stoical. They don't show any signs, feelings of any sort. It's very amusing, a little story I might tell you, which always amused me, was strange enough, the North Koreans had never seen coloured people before. In fact, had never seen a Negro. And I know they captured one from the one of the Negro battalions. The Americans had some Negro battalions there, officered by usually American white officers who officered them. And they were very difficult battalions to handle. And it was decided after World War II they'd have their own Negro battalions. And this Negro battalion, unfortunately, the Negroes do not like digging trenches. And in fact, they felt they were digging their own graves, and some of them, even when they dug them, didn't like going into them. Anyway, I'm told that the North Koreans and Chinese would instinctively attack a Negro battalion, hoping to take off, and thereby capture all their weapons, because they're always looking for more weapons. One of the Negroes, I'm told this, but the fact is true, was captured by the Chinese, and they'd never seen a coloured man before, and they all hung around him, waiting around him, and he couldn't think why they were all waiting around him. And after about half an hour, he thought he'd better go and relieve himself. And then they woke up. That's what they're waiting for. They wanted to see if he was black all over. They weren't disappointed. It's quite an interesting story.
But what was the problem with handling the Negro battalions?
Well, the Negroes are first-rate at mechanics and driving vehicles and that sort of job. I personally don't think they're terribly good soldiers. Their heart's not in it, and they weren't good soldiers. And latterly, I'm told they broke them up to put so many coloured people in each battalion and did not work as a complete battalion. And it strengthened the force by doing that.
What did you think of the general calibre of the American allies?
Well, the Americans are great people for taking casualties. They take more casualties than any force because they've got a large manpower, whereas the British Army is very small comparatively, and we've had enormous casualties in previous wars. We're not prepared to take enormous casualties. And they will, you know, will take unnecessary casualties, in my view. And the interesting thing was that because of the shape of the country, a peninsula, it was laid out rather like World War I, with a front line running right across the country. And with the forces we had, we were just able to have a line going right across the country, with divisions all the way along the line, and with the United States Marine divisions, who always have to be in front, their front line was at least 4 or 5 miles in front of the rest of the army, which is rather amusing. You wanted to look at the front line, there was always a big wave in it when you came to the Marine division, because they wanted to be in front of everyone else, because they are magnificent soldiers and really good fighters. The interesting thing about the way the American army is run, or this Korean War was run, is that all those in the front line, down as far as brigade headquarters or combat team headquarters, which is the American equivalent, rate as combat. And therefore you get all the perks. In fact, the food brought to us, we were on American food, was magnificent. Real steaks, salmon steaks, and excellent food were brought in, quite different to our English compo ration or field service ration. And we really were on good food. Now, those people in combat were entitled to be finished, only have to do 1 year on active service, and then we were repatriated home. Those behind the lines and the bases might do quite a lengthy tour. In the British case, everyone in Korea was not supposed to do more than 1 year. And anyone finishing 18 months, who had to do longer, 18 months, would count as a full overseas tour, which is a 3 year, would double it, count as an overseas tour. I did a year, and nearly everyone else did a year.
What about the motivation of the British troops there? Did they feel it was their war? Were their hearts in it?
Yes. I think that after, to start with, we all thought we were going to arrive there too late and wanted to get there in time. And then the next sort of feeling was we were home by, you know, be all over by Christmas, or be all over very soon. And, you know, once we'd got across the parallel, it'd be all over. But, of course, it wasn't, because, you see, when we went across the parallel, the Chinese came in, and so then it became a lengthy war until the negotiations started almost after 18 months of the war. Negotiations started, and then any fighting took place was only started by the Chinese to increase their bargaining power at negotiating conferences.
But did the troops come out with expressions such as, why on earth are we here? What are we doing here?
No, I don't think they did come out with any of those sort of expressions like that. They realised why we were there and were proud to be taking part in this United Nations effort against communism. Those of them who were communists when they came out, I think, soon changed their mind when they saw how the communists behaved. I think we must have had communists there. The people I was sorry for were the ones who had been prisoners of war, and it's strange enough, there must have been quite a few who were prisoners of war with the Far East. And then the terrible thing was that after the Amjin battle, where the Gloucesters had very heavy casualties, and most of them were not killed, were put into the bag as prisoners, some of them had already been prisoners of war. And here they were going to do another 2 years as prisoners of war. And it's a sad thing to spend your life in prison.
The national servicemen you had with you, how did they perform?
We didn't have national servicemen with us. You see, I've said at the beginning, we became regulars. It's all regulars. It's the first regular war. We're all regulars. It's a regular army at war. And the only people who were national service were in the other brigade, 27th Brigade. And later on, when the reinforcements came in, relieved us after a year. The people like the Welsh Regiment and the North Staffords who came in, they were with National Service. But in our case, we were a fully regular outfit. And the amount of knowledge there, you see, we had those gunners I'm particularly fond of, because I saw a lot of them, have been firing weapons, you see, in the whole of World War II. And here they were again, and they fired in action over 100,000 rounds, which not many regiments ever done that.
Did you feel that you had the edge on the other brigade then? Because
we were known as the Rolls-Royce Brigade, strange enough. Well, we never thought we were any Rolls-Royce, because we had up to full strength, and we had clothing given us, and we had the vehicles. Whereas 27 Brigade, you see, hadn't any tropic, hadn't any cold weather kit at all. They'd come from Hong Kong off garrison duties. And they were the people who had really a tough time and did extremely well even before we arrived.
Now, there was quite a lot of controversy at the time in 1950-51 about General MacArthur and his wanting to use the atomic bomb on China. Were you in the British Army aware of that controversy? Did it come down
to
you?
Well, no, we didn't know what he was planning to do, but I think many of us thought it seemed funny, having got to the 48th parallel, the war didn't end there, but they wanted, of course, to make sure it didn't happen again, and by giving the North Koreans, kept beating them. But, of course, what they hadn't realised is that once you come onto a peninsula on the edge of a huge continent, where can the war end? I mean, it's no good saying the yellow, and no one seems to notice the fact there was a huge force being built up the other side of the yellow by the Chinese. And in any case, the Chinese, I think, came into the war for their own protection. I think they thought that the Americans were going to go across the yellow and attack them. But MacArthur was relieved. I did see him there. And then they brought in this magnificent chap, Ridgway, because morale, after the withdrawal across through Seoul and behind the Imjin, morale was very low amongst Americans and everyone else. And I remember being in headquarters, and General Ridgway, just been appointed, coming along, and said, "What are your plans? What are the brigade plans?" And I don't know why I was answering for anyone, but I suppose I was the only person there. And I said, "Well, we're planning to go somewhere south if we're attacked, or somewhere else if we're overrun." And he said, "We're no more overrunning, we're going to advance." And he went round everywhere, and he changed the whole face of the force. And he was a magnificent-looking chap. And he used to wear these two grenades on his chest. I don't know whether they were alive or not, but they looked as though they were. And he was a very impressionable man and a tremendous character. And he changed, right through his own influence, he changed the whole face of the force. And if no more withdrawals, it'll be attack and attack, and that's all I'm going to do.
Can we go on now to the Chinese attack at the Imjin, and can you tell me what you recollect of that?
Well, now, you've now told me where I cannot tell you anything at all, because it so happened on about 2 days before the Imjin battle, about the 20th, 19th of April, I went with the 8th Hussars. They asked me to come along with them, and we went on a nice probe north. We must have gone 15 to 20 miles in these tanks to see what was going on and make a probe. And there wasn't a soul there, except one platoon we came across. And I remember the chap in my tank hopped out, and we grabbed a prisoner and put him in the back of the tank with me. And or it could have been an armoured carrier. Anyway, this prisoner was picked up there. And when interviewed, he said, "I'm surprised you attacked us. I thought we were going to attack you." Anyway, we came back, and as I was due for my R&R, it was called, rest and rehabilitation, and you were allowed to have 5 days, and you were flown out to Tokyo Airport, and you had accommodation given you in a hotel there, the Marunouchi, and you had 5 days, magnificent holiday in Japan. You had plenty of money because you couldn't have spent a penny there. You see, you couldn't spend anything in Korea. There was nothing to buy. Most of the stuff was given you. In fact, things like sweets and things like that, and those sort of things. In one of the withdrawals through Seoul, we'd lost the whole of the American PX. PX is the, you know what it is, it's a naffy. And we were allowed to send trucks along to help ourselves. And I had, I don't know how many boxes of Spangles. It's the one sweet I never want to see again. Anyway, we had this great holiday in Japan. And while I was there, it must have been the day after I arrived, the Imjin battle started. And so I was not there during the Imjin battle.
You mentioned earlier about the Chinese wanting to get hold of Allied weapons to use. Mm. Were you aware of the use of Allied weapons against you?
Not personally, because I wouldn't have known. I mean, I wasn't in the fighting line at all. But I'm sure they, as most people, all armies do use each other's weapons. If they can use them, they always seem to find they like the other weapons better whenever it happens that way. I know we used to use German weapons in World War II, and vice versa.
Did you ever use Chinese weapons?
No, I never saw them.
You said a little bit about the good quality of the food that you were receiving, mm-hmm. but what were living conditions like in the...
Well, the strange thing about this, you see, that the beginning of the thing, the beginning of the winter, whenever one could, we tried to find some sort of accommodation. Some old building. Fortunately, there were a good many schools in North Korea and in South Korea, schools and odd buildings. And they're strange buildings because they're all based on the use of underfloor heating done with hard fuel. Of course, we hadn't got the hard fuel, and of course, there are no windows, and they usually were thatched, and there's a great risk of fire from catching fire. And I remember one poor chap who was asked to go and join one of the, I think it was Northumberland Fusil Air Company, and while he was there, the company commander managed to find one room of a barn, and they had people use space heaters. A space heater is a petrol heater, highly dangerous. And we've had a lot of casualties these things because they'd perhaps catch fire, things catch fire from them because they get red hot. Or they could be put into a closed tent or accommodation and the fumes would kill you. And so there's great danger of these space heaters. But anyway, this chap was told to keep the place warm while they went on patrol. And of course he set fire to the...